Nathan. Arr, matey, Adam would say, donning a pirate hat. He'd sword fight with his son and draw maps that would lead them to treasure he buried in the sand at a nearby playground.
If he had to be home recovering after a procedure, says Kelly, he was going to play with the kids as much as he could.
Adam's task unit was scheduled to deploy to Iraq in April 2004. This gave him 7 months to both heal his eye as much as possible and retrain himself to work around the injury. Even with limited vision, he was able to excel in and successfully complete a highly competitive 1 month Naval Special Warfare Assault Breacher course. The breacher is the SEAL who gains access to a building or compound during a raid so the rest of the assault team can enter the target structure. He is the first to sneak up to an objective while the rest of the team holds security from a distance. As an explosives expert, the breacher can also safely implode whatever stands between the SEALs and the enemy, a door, a gate, or a wall. In addition, Adam taught himself to shoot using his non-dominant left eye. This didn't affect how he held a handgun, but aiming an M4 carbine required that he turn his head and lean out over the stock for accuracy. Once the platoon workup was finished, Adam was cleared by medical, having exhibited proficiency in SEAL tasks, but with the notation that he was doing so with limited vision in his dominant eye. He flew to Baghdad for a 6-month deployment, and upon his arrival, Adam's superiors decided that his limited vision was a liability. They would not allow Adam to participate with his platoon in direct action combat missions on the ground. This had been a possibility, he knew, but he thought it was a slim one, especially considering his most recent evaluation, based significantly on the training he'd taken part in after his eye injury. In the evaluation, the Master Chief had stated that Adam was his first choice for the toughest jobs. He'd gone even further and recommended Adam for NSW DevGru. Instead, Adam was given a job working with intelligence as part of a reconnaissance-focused task unit. As a team player, he dealt positively with his disappointment. He thought he'd work hard and prove himself and then persuade leadership to clear him for direct action, says one of his Team 2 teammates. That was his plan. For the first few weeks in Iraq, while Adam's teammates were conducting special reconnaissance, sniper missions, and raids, capturing or killing insurgents, clearing houses, and gathering intelligence, Adam tirelessly performed a myriad of support tasks while based in the northern city of Mosul. He constructed the C4 charges his team used for explosive entry. He took aerial photographs of target buildings and neighborhoods from airplanes and helicopters. He participated in the interrogation of captured insurgents, and most importantly, he pored over intelligence and played a lead role in planning missions. Knowing how SEALs operate and with a keen sense for strategy, he developed a systematic approach for intelligence and operations fusion, wrote his commanding officer in evaluating Adam's performance after the deployment. His techniques were used to positively identify follow-on targets within 24 to 48 hours and facilitated an accelerated targeting cycle that resulted in the capture of 36 known anti-coalition fighters in less than 2 months of combat operations. He was making huge contributions, doing really important work, says Austin. They just would not let him do all of what we were doing because of his eye. Adam continued to feel sidelined, and it drove him crazy. He didn't realize he was probably working harder than anybody on the team. Back in Hot Springs, Kelly had no idea what Adam or any of the SEALs were contributing to the war effort, and to preserve operational security, Adam couldn't tell her in his emails and phone calls. She could only trust in his training and pray for his and the entire unit's safe return. Janice and Larry liked to keep abreast of what was going on in the war by watching the daily news, but Kelly would often walk away from the television. Not only did it escalate her worry, it also infuriated her whenever the U.S. military was portrayed in a negative light. She was livid at the soldiers who had taken part in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal.
It reflected poorly on all the military, says Kelly. It reflected poorly on my Adam.
It was so important to her that their children understand their father's efforts in the war
that Kelly had given Adam a journal before he deployed and made him promise to write about his experiences.
"When Nathan and Savannah are older," explains Kelly, "I want them to understand the war, not from the media or their school history books, but from the perspective of their daddy, who fought in it."
After only 6 weeks in Iraq, in spite of the limitations placed on him by his superiors, Adam had a firm grasp on how this war was being fought, especially how intelligence was gathered and extracted from prisoners. On May 10th, the same day the New Yorker magazine reported numerous instances of sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses in its cover story, Torture at Abu Ghraib, Adam sat down on his bunk at the end of a 15-hour workday in Mosul. He picked up the stuffed toy duck Savannah had sent with him and wrote about how he could still smell his little baby on it. He pushed around the toy number 24 race car from Nathan. Then he wrote them a letter. "Dear Nathan and Savannah, let it be known that if it weren't for you kids, I'd be sleeping right now. But I promised your mom I'd write in this journal for you. I want you to know, as you read opinions and history in school about 2004, that going to this war was right. No matter what you hear 20 years from now by elite media and historians, things get distorted. Just like Vietnam, I fear OIF, Operation Iraqi Freedom, will be abused in the same way. Just as you hear more about American soldiers in Vietnam raping women and children and shooting unarmed men, today the media is focused about this detainee debacle for 2 weeks solid, in contrast to American soldiers being dragged in the streets and dismembered, which was covered for less than 72 hours. I'm part of the Special Operations Forces elite. Our detention center is for the sole purpose of obtaining evidence as quickly as possible for rounding up more terrorists. We are harder than anyone at these detention centers, and let me tell you, we treat these guys with the utmost professionalism. We do not hit them, we don't humiliate them, or cause them any bodily harm for the purpose of entertainment. This is war, and treated very seriously. People are being killed, and it is our job to get information. Honestly, it's the hardest thing I've ever done. I fight for people's freedoms, not to take them away. The humanity in me wants to warn them, tell them their family is okay, feed them, and even embrace them in a loving way. As a Christian, one assumes great compassion. Most, even in my stature, feel the same way. This is the American soldier. As for the punks that have humiliated our country and our sovereignty, I show them no pity and insist they are in the deepest minority of American professionals. What they did was not to gain intel, only to elevate their weak and pathetic lives to a status for some reason they have only dreamed of. My hand hurts, and I can only imagine what my sleepiness has caused me to write on this paper. You kids, Nathan and Savannah, y'all are so precious to me. I get chills thinking about watching you grow. You're both already so big. If your mom and I ever teach you anything, I pray it is at least to show all people courtesy and respect. The truly courageous and powerful never have to prove it. It is always shown in their actions. I love you dearly. Daddy."
Chapter 13. Something Important. Late in May 2004, Adam was recruited by the CIA, for a few hours anyway, when a case officer learned he was good with electronics. A local resident's vehicle, to be used for drive-by reconnaissance missions in Mosul, needed to have installed a discrete surveillance system with its own power source. The system also had to be remotely activated. "I used parts from a bomb maker's house that we did a hit on earlier this week," Adam wrote in his journal. "He's giving back and doing his part to fight terrorism, and doesn't even know it." While lending a hand to the CIA, Adam met a seasoned DevGru operator named Dale, who had worked with Chief Harley. They discussed Operation Red Dawn, which had led to the capture of Saddam Hussein on December 13, 2003, near Tikrit, as well as Osama bin Laden
and how Dale hoped to be the guy who took Bin Laden out when the time came. That was, to Dale, the ultimate mission, the Big Mish. The conversation segued to Adam's recommendation for Green Team, the 7-month proving ground selection course for those seeking to move up to DevGru. "He was really humble about it," says Dale. "Adam was smart about how he got information. Some guys are annoying with their questions or come off as cocky. But Adam was so genuine, you wanted to give him all you could. And one question he asked me was why I chose to go to that next level. I explained it to Adam like this," he continues. "Guys will say they're going to get out and do something else. But honestly, the reason guys don't go, the only reason a SEAL from the regular teams won't go to Green Team, is because he's afraid of failing. Because if you fail out of Green Team, then you're automatically ranked in the SEAL teams as not good enough to be a DevGru. And, some of us might say, not good enough to be a SEAL. If you don't go, then you're never ranked. Or you can still think you're a hotshot at the regular team level, but that's only because you've never been tested at the next level. The big thing for a SEAL is how many platoons you've done. Like, this guy did 7 platoons. He's a badass." I told Adam, "I don't care if you did 100 platoons. I'm kind of a snob that way, and a lot of guys are. If you don't at least try for DevGru, then I really don't want to talk to you. Not to be a dick, but I'm just saying, why wouldn't you? Who are they going to call first when the Big Mish goes down?" After 2 months in northern Iraq, Adam's unit was assigned the mission of protecting top Iraqi government leaders, including the Iraqi president and prime minister. His platoon would relocate to Baghdad immediately. As a member of the support team for Team 2 in Mosul, Adam had planned nearly a dozen successful direct action raids and missions that resulted in the capture or killing of numerous insurgents. But not once had he been allowed to participate himself. Now he was informed that he also would not be allowed to take part in the security detail protecting the Iraqi leaders, and was given the option of going home. "We all talked about it," says Austin. "He didn't want to leave us, but we agreed. Go home, try to get your vision back with surgery, and gear up for the next deployment." He had to take a step back to take a step forward. And that wasn't easy for Adam, who was always in fifth gear. But he did it. Kelly was still in Hot Springs with Nathan and Savannah the first week in June when Adam called her from Virginia Beach. "They benched me," he said, explaining how he'd been held back because of his eye. Then he told her he wanted to screen for Green Team, the selection course for DevGru. According to documentation, fewer than 15% of more than 2,000 SEALs on active duty at the time had successfully screened for the course. That is, been approved to participate in it. Those who actually pass are considered the top 1% of the SEAL community, the absolute best of the best.
"He was fired up," says Kelly. "And I was thinking, wait a minute, you just told me in that last sentence that you got benched." "Baby," she interjected, "you have only one good eye, and the doctor says that's probably not going to change."
"That's why I want to go for Green Team," Adam said. "If I don't pass the screening, then I'll know. Then we'll have to think about what's next. If I'm not going to get to do my job, I don't want to be strung along."
While Adam had accepted that the bad choices he'd made, quitting football in college, the drugs, the crimes, had led him to where he was now, he still regretted them. That regret strengthened his resolve this time to push through until he could push no further.
"Itty bitty, remember when you prayed about us back when I seemed hopeless, and God never once told you to leave? Well, I've been praying too, and all I'm getting, all I'm feeling in my heart, is that I'm not done. I've still got a lot of fight in me. I want to do something I can be proud of. I want to do something that's going to make a difference. And I have not had the chance to do it yet."
"All right then," Kelly said. "Let's keep praying about it. If you get in, it's God. If not, we'll figure it out."
With Adam back in the United States, Kelly wanted to return to Virginia Beach as soon as possible,
but it was summer and rentals were hard to come by, at least in their price range. Even with a recent promotion to the E6 pay grade, Adam's net income as a SEAL, including some extra cash he made cutting down trees in residential neighborhoods, was about $3,000 a month. Still, with two kids, three maxed-out credit cards, a car payment, and life and auto insurance, they had managed to save $2,500 for a down payment on a house of their own. After a couple of weeks in Virginia Beach, during which Adam stayed in the bachelor barracks for free, Kelly said to him,
"I'll do anything to be there with you. We'll camp if we have to until we can find a place."
That's exactly what they ended up doing, buying the cheapest tent and air mattresses on the shelf at Walmart and camping in the midsummer heat as a family at the Little Creek base compound.
"It was insane," says Kelly. "I do not know what I was thinking. We were slipping and sliding in our own sweat, the sheets were soaking wet, and that was at night when it was only in the 90s, with 90% humidity. During the day, it topped 100. Both of the kids had heat rash, and little Savannah was getting potty trained, so you can imagine changing diapers with a flashlight in what felt like a steam bath inside that tent."
When Adam went to work each morning, Kelly piled the kids in the car and drove, blasting the AC and searching for a place to live, as well as spending hours in stores, malls, the library, anywhere there was air conditioning. They were all trying to sleep one night when Nathan spoke up.
"Daddy," he said, "are we in hell? 'Cause I think hell's hot like this." "I was at my rope's end by the end of our first week of camping," says Kelly. "Then one of the guys on Team 2 who was about to deploy offered to let us stay in his condo, his air-conditioned condo, and we jumped on it."
They moved into the SEAL's place the following day, and it was
truly a bachelor pad, says Kelly. Nathan went exploring and showed me a poster on the wall and asked, "Mommy, why are those two girls naked and hugging?" And I told him, "Well, they must be sisters and they love each other. They're cuddling."
She sat him down in the living room, then walked through the condo, removing X-rated posters and magazines and toning it down to a family-friendly G. Then she tackled the bathroom, which she suspected had not been cleaned that century.
"Don't get me wrong," notes Kelly. "I was so grateful to be staying there. It just shows how the SEALs take care of each other. But for that bathroom, I wore gloves. There were things growing in there science couldn't identify. I needed a chisel for the bathtub."
2 weeks later, the Browns were able to rent a little house, complete with picket fence, in the Virginia Beach suburbs, and Adam began the screening process for Green Team, along with Austin and Christian. On the questionnaire, Adam stated his reasons for entering Buds and the SEAL community: to serve this country in the highest possible manner, to do things that others cannot. To the question, "Do you have any past or present injuries or physical condition which detracts from your physical capabilities?" he answered, "I was shot in the eye with a sim round. Temporary. I expect a full recovery." This was followed by an oral board review and written and oral psychological testing, a phase that approximately half the applicants fail. Adam, Austin, and Christian passed, with Austin and Christian placed on the roster for the next Green Team selection course, scheduled to begin in mid-2005. On his doctor's advice, Adam chose to postpone Green Team for another year. Once he was screened, his slot was reserved for a future class of his choosing. In the entire history of Naval Special Warfare Development Group, nobody had ever attempted, much less passed, the stringent Green Team qualifications with good vision in only one eye. Especially close quarters battle, CQB, where peripheral vision and split-second reaction times are critical. The deferral meant further experience as a SEAL, another platoon, another deployment, and more time for Adam to either regain his sight fully or adapt to living and working with near blindness in his right eye. In the interim, he planned at least one more surgery to improve his vision. The surgery was not a success.
"In fact," says Kelly, "the eye seemed to get worse."
What movement Adam could make out with his right eye became even blurrier. Kelly tested him by waving her hand around.
He'd say, "I can see what you're doing there," explains Kelly. But he couldn't see how many fingers I would hold up or anything like that. He caught flashes of light and movement, but that was about it. He couldn't read a stop sign out of that eye if he was 3 feet away.
Realizing that his vision was not going to improve, Adam decided the best training for the DevGru selection process would be qualifying for and attending the Naval Special Warfare Sniper School, arguably the most difficult advanced combat course in the Navy, outside of Green Team. "By far the hardest school I ever went through," says Christian. "I was more relieved to finish that than Bud's. Tons of pressure every day, and I had both of my eyes to rely on." Adam had attempted sniper school once before, in 2002 when both eyes were functioning, but had failed the attritional stalking portion of the course, as did nearly half his class, which drove him even harder to complete the 3-month course now. To do that, he needed to master stealth, patience, and camouflage. He had to judge distances with absolute accuracy, anticipate the wind's effect on a bullet's trajectory, and learn a new language universal to Navy snipers. "But really," says Christian, "the root of the course is teaching us to be silent hunters who can stalk our prey." "Imagine a field full of sniper students," he continues, "who have been given 4 hours to move over 1,000 yards, set up a hide sight within 150 to 250 meters of the target without being detected, and there's at least 5 guys with spotting scopes sitting on a truck trying to bust you. All they have to do is see you, identify you in the landscape. They did not cut us any breaks at all. It was huge having to be an NSW sniper, and they weren't going to hand it out to just anybody." Between January and April 2005, Adam not only completed the 3 segments of the course, photo image capture, scout, and sniper, he also excelled in them. It was a punishing pace, 13 to 15-hour days, 6 days a week, divided between Little Creek, Virginia, and Camp Atterbury, Indiana. Students endured daily physical training and weekly Monster Mash workouts that rivaled professional triathlons. They had to master 1,000-meter stalks with a 2-hour time limit, photographing or killing moving, stationary, and pop-up targets ranging from 100 to 1,200 yards out, and building ghillie suits that matched the environment. Since snipers work in teams of 2, students must learn both shooter and spotter skills and know their weapons inside out. "You learn how to be invisible with your partner in any terrain," says Brad Weston, a fellow SEAL who became friends with Adam during the course. "And then you must either take a clear photograph or put a bullet through the head of a target." The final exam is built into a brutal ruck march, where each student, shouldering a weapon plus a 60-pound rucksack, is tested at intervals along a 14-mile course through urban areas, mountainous terrain, and seemingly flat-as-pancake fields on which he must find minuscule rises to hide behind. All the skills learned during the previous months, including steady, accurate shots, must be performed while students are exhausted. To master this demanding curriculum, Adam completely changed his shooting stance, learning to shoot left-handed so as best to accommodate his non-dominant eye. He passed sniper school on April 8th, a feat that Brad, a lifelong hunter, considers next to godly. "There was someone out there," says Brad, "who was just like, 'Adam, you will make it.' And Adam was like, 'Okay, got it.' I can't explain it any other way. To lose vision in your good eye within a year prior to that class and say, 'Screw it, I'm going to sniper school, and oh, by the way, I'll do it left-handed,' that's hardcore. I don't think it's ever been done in the history of sniper schools in the world." Graduating from sniper school was a huge confidence boost for Adam, and with Nathan starting kindergarten in the fall, he and Kelly decided to invest their small savings in a first home. Navy financing helped keep the mortgage about par with their current rent payment, and in April they purchased a 3-bedroom house in the Virginia Beach suburbs. As Adam dived into the workup for his next deployment with Team 2, Christian and Austin sweated out the Green Team selection process.
One weekend in early June, the three SEALs and their families went swimming at Becky and Christian's condo. Staying cool by wading around the shallow end of the pool, Christian and Austin swapped stories about some of the mind-boggling scenarios they'd faced in the 3 months they'd been powering through the course. When they moved inside, Kelly noticed that Adam was subdued.
"This is so hard for Adam," she quietly told Christian. "He just wants to be there with you guys so bad."
Christian and Austin dropped the subject, but it became the elephant in the room. Finally, Christian threw his arm around Adam and said, "You will crush it next year, buddy." At the end of the month, Adam was in the Team 2 building when he heard the terrible news. 19 Americans, 11 SEALs and 8 pilots and crewmen from the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment had been killed in Afghanistan. 8 of the SEALs, from Team 10, had been based at Little Creek. The Team 10 SEALs had been sent out on June 28th as part of a quick reaction force to aid a 4-man SEAL reconnaissance team that was outnumbered, outpositioned, and pinned down by anti-coalition insurgents in a fierce firefight in the mountainous Kunar province. An enemy rocket-propelled grenade had struck their helicopter, and the resulting explosion and impact killed everyone on board. At Little Creek, 10 days later, Adam stood at attention during a memorial service for the fallen SEALs. It had been the worst single-day loss of life in the history of naval special warfare. Captain Pete Van Hooser, who had pinned Adam with his trident and was now the commander of Naval Special Warfare Group 2, nodded toward Adam and the other uniformed SEALs in the crowd. But his focus in his moving remarks was on the photos of those who had given their lives, as well as on their family members, in particular, the wives and children of the fallen. "I am always humbled in the presence of warriors," Van Hooser said to the hushed crowd of thousands. "We have been in sustained combat for over 3 years. Things have changed. I find myself speaking in public a lot more than I would like, but I always start by thanking 4 groups of people. The first are our warriors who have fallen. The second, those who have guaranteed that those who have fallen will not be left behind. Some with bravery, others with their lives. I thank those who have selflessly pulled themselves off the line to train the next warriors to go forward, so that they may surpass the prowess of those currently engaged. And I am thankful for the families that nurture such men. Take care of Sissy and Mommy," Adam said to Nathan on October 5th, giving a discreet wink to Kelly. "You're the man of the house while I'm away."
"I will, Daddy," said the 5-year-old. "Don't you worry."
Kelly put her hand on her heart, watching as Adam picked up 3-year-old Savannah and hugged her tightly. It was both sweet and terrifying to think of the burden her little boy had taken on so bravely and naively. For his deployment, Adam's 3rd and his 2nd to a combat zone, he had been cleared for direct action, having proven that his virtually blind eye was not a liability. 6 months, Adam told Kelly when they finally hugged.
"Christmas will be the hardest," she replied, feeling a lump in her throat.
She and Michelle had talked about and prayed for the widows of the men killed in June, and though she didn't know any of them personally, the SEAL community was an extended family, so she felt a bond with and a deep sadness for the families. Beyond the sadness, they also represented her greatest fear. Kelly swallowed the lump and slammed the door shut on her emotions. She'd vowed to be strong for Nathan and Savannah, who had grown accustomed to Adam's trips. That was all this was to the children, a longer one than usual, but still just a trip. Adam knew exactly what Kelly was feeling. "Don't worry about me," he said. "You got the toughest job. Mine's easy." A kiss, and he was off. The minute the family returned home from saying goodbye to Daddy, Nathan went upstairs to his bathroom and moved his toothbrush into his parents' master bathroom.
"Mommy," he said, Y'all let me know if you need me to do anything.
Then he went about his business, which at the moment was building Legos. The following morning, Kelly opened the sugar bowl to make sweet tea and found a little scrap of paper within. It read, "You are so special. Love, Adam." Every day she'd find another note. In the cookie jar, "I miss you today. Love, Adam." In a dresser drawer, "I wish for a kiss. Love, Adam." Inside the egg carton, "Give yourself a hug and pretend it's me. Love, Adam." Cherishing each discovery, Kelly refrained from searching for all the notes at once. She kept them in her wallet and reread them whenever she needed a lift. And by the end of Adam's first month of deployment, the once crisp papers were like those in their family Bible, worn and soft. They sustained her. At the memorial service for the fallen SEALs, Captain Van Hooser had defined what coalition forces were up against in the landlocked country where Adam was deployed. "The enemy we face in Afghanistan is as hard and tough as the land they inhabit. They come from a long line of warriors who have prevailed in the face of many armies for centuries. It is their intimate knowledge of every inch of the most rugged terrain on earth that is matched against our skill, cunning, and technology. They are worthy adversaries, and our intelligence confirms that they fear and respect us. They have learned to carefully choose their fights, because SEALs will answer the bell every time." Indeed, Adam respected the land he surveyed from Bagram Airfield, where he and his task unit were initially based. As a SEAL, he knew to never underestimate the enemy, but he also rejoiced, according to his journal, when he saw children playing in a field with a soccer ball as he patrolled in and around the ancient city of Bagram. Adam continued the journal entry to his children. "From everything I've read, seeing these kids, including girls, playing, tells me we are doing right here. I have not gotten a single sour face from any of the locals, and I don't see fear in their eyes. I'm sure I will learn more over time. They are poor. Y'all cannot believe what little they have, Nathan and Savannah. But we have restored their dignity and their lives. The Taliban had taken that away. Read Mari's letter in book, Sewing Circles of Herat. Kids, I am proud to be here doing what we are doing." During his personal quest to learn about Afghanistan, Adam had read a book titled The Sewing Circles of Herat, A Personal Voyage Through Afghanistan, by Christina Lamb. The letter he referred to was sent to Lamb by a secretly educated young Afghan woman named Mari. "Dear Christina, I hope this will help you outside understand the feelings of an educated Afghan female who must now live under a burqa." For 2 pages, the letter described Mari's background with various anecdotes of life before and after the Taliban, ending with, "Life here is very miserable. We have no rights at all, and we have asked many times other countries of the world for help, but they have been silent. Now we heard about this attack on the towers in America with many people dead, and my father says the Americans will come and remove the Taliban. But we do not dare hope. I do not know what you want me to write to you. If I start writing, I will fill all the paper, and my eyes will fill with tears, because in these 7 years of Taliban, no one has asked us to write about our lives. In my mind, I make a picture of you and your family. I wonder if you drive a car, if you go out with friends to the cinema and restaurants and dance at parties. Do you play loud music and swim in lakes? One day I would like to see. And I would also like to show you a beautiful place in my country with mountains and streams. But not now, while we must be hidden. Maybe our worlds will always be too far apart. Mari." For the first few weeks in country, Adam and his task unit flew from Bagram to outlying villages. Their living quarters were 8-foot by 8-foot plywood rooms with a blanket for a door, a bunk, and some shelves in a building built by Army engineers where the Taliban had surrendered 4 years before. Adam's missions were with a team of doctors who provided care to the locals, and in many cases their animals, while the SEALs provided security. After a month of supporting this MedCap VetCap, Medical Civic Action Program / Veterinarian Civic Action Program mission, winning the hearts and minds of the indigenous population, the task unit was ordered to relocate. Adam was preparing his gear for the move when his buddy, FBI agent Billy White, who had been accompanying the SEALs on the mission, stopped by his room, the walls of which were covered in graffiti from its many different residents. One message was, "Life is not a journey to the grave with the intention of arriving safely in a pretty and preserved body, but rather to skid in broadside, thoroughly used up, totally worn out, and loudly proclaiming, 'Wow, what a ride.'" Billy liked it so much he jotted it down in his journal. Then he noticed Adam's Bible, the cover bent, pages marked, and it sparked a conversation about their shared Christian faith and how they both believed God had led them to fight in this war. "Neither of us had seen actual combat at that point," says Billy, "and we talked of being warriors and Christians and mentally dealing with killing. Specifically, we talked about how the Bible says, 'Thou shalt not murder.' It does not say, 'Thou shalt not kill.' There is a time to kill, to protect your home, your family, your freedom." And when I said that to Adam, he replied, "Amen, brother." The following morning, Adam and Billy were in a vehicle heading south from Bagram, part of the relocation convoy of 5 Humvees. They rounded a corner and saw an International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, convoy coming from the opposite direction, barreling down the middle of the narrow 2-lane blacktop at 60 to 70 miles an hour, roughly the same speed as Adam's convoy. The lead vehicles in both convoys edged over into their own lanes, but in doing so dropped their outer tires into powdery dirt, instantly creating a large dust cloud. Adam was riding in the front passenger seat of the second Humvee, his right hand holding on to the upper frame of the open window, when the wall of dust appeared. Their driver barely had time to tap the vehicle's brakes before it was swallowed by the blinding cloud, and an instant later, the left front bumper impacted with the second vehicle in the ISAF convoy, causing a glancing head-on collision. Adam's Humvee flipped 3 times while cartwheeling down the blacktop. The dust cleared, and Dave Kane, a SEAL in the undamaged lead vehicle, saw Adam leaning into the back seat of the smashed Humvee administering aid to somebody who was "howling like a dog that got run over by a car," says Dave. Billy was pinned between the caved-in roof, a piece which had speared through his left quadriceps muscle, and the seat and floorboard. His lower left leg was crushed, and a bone protruded through his calf muscle from a compound fracture. The left side of Billy's head and his ear were torn open, his left wrist was disfigured and broken, and his M4 carbine, which he'd been holding muzzle up between his legs, had been driven through his left armpit into his back so that it could be seen bulging against the skin there. These were only the visible injuries. "Adam was applying pressure, trying to stop the bleeding on Billy's leg," says Dave. "Billy was screaming. Another guy had gotten thrown out and was in shock, sort of stumbling around. The guy next to Billy thought his back was broken, but was still trying to help Adam with Billy. Then a corpsman from the rear of our convoy ran up, and Adam yelled at him, 'Give Billy his morphine! Give him his morphine!'" As Adam helped extract Billy and the other injured men from the mangled vehicle, Dave noticed Adam's right hand. Its fingers were dangling by skin and tendons, every digit but the thumb severed. When the Humvee began to flip, the hand that had been gripping the window frame was crushed between it and the road. "Adam, your hand is messed up," Dave said. "Yeah, yeah," said Adam. "I'm all right. Focus on these guys." A corpsman overheard. "Hey, I need to take a look," he told Adam. After examining the injury, the corpsman carefully laid Adam's fingers back into place and bandaged his hand. Local men, women, and children had begun to gather, watching the scene. A stopped convoy dealing with a medical trauma was a target of opportunity, and the enemy could easily be hidden within the crowd.
"Let's keep these people back,"
yelled Adam, standing up and grabbing his M4 with his uninjured hand. Says Dave, he balanced the stock on the forearm above his bandages and started holding security. I told him, Adam, sit down, man. We got it. Relax. But Adam shook his head and kept pushing people away from the wreckage. When the helicopter landed, there was Adam, still holding security for his own medevac, refusing to get loaded until all the others were tended to and on board. Only then did he lower his weapon and join them. Chapter 14. Green Team. Kelly was driving north, approaching the Hampton Roads bridge tunnel when her cell phone rang. From the forlorn tone of Adam's voice, she knew instantly something was wrong.
I'm coming home, baby, he said. Oh, Adam, what happened? Are you okay? Talk fast. I'm coming up on the tunnel.
Well, he said, I got in an accident. Unable to pull over, Kelly entered the tunnel and lost the call. Once she was on the other side, Adam called back and filled her in. Somewhat.
He was so casual about these horrible injuries, Kelly said. He was in the hospital and was like, I hurt my hand pretty bad. My fingers got cut off, but I got them sewn back on. He was most worried about his friend who was in surgery and in critical condition, lucky to be alive.
Adam asked her to call his parents.
And itty-bitty, he said.
Have everybody we know pray for a guy named Billy White. Initial surgeries for both Adam and Billy were performed the day of the accident in the Heath N. Craig Joint Theater Hospital at Bagram Airfield. The following morning, they flew together to Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany, where Billy was operated on more extensively. Adam remained with Billy so he could accompany him home 3 days later. When they returned to the States, Billy went to Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., and Adam was driven home for reconstructive hand surgery at Portsmouth Naval Hospital in Virginia Beach.
It wasn't until he got home that night, says Kelly, that I saw his fingers hadn't just been cut off. They'd been crushed off between the Humvee and the road. It looked so painful.
The next day, Adam checked in at the hospital and insisted on a local anesthetic so he could watch the procedure.
He chatted with the surgeons with his hand laid open on the table, says Kelly. He watched them work on his nerves, muscles, tendons, every cut, stitch, screw, and pin. He saw it all.
Janice and Larry had monitored Adam's situation from Hot Springs since the accident. Kelly always kept us informed, says Larry, who would then pass the information on to Sean and Manda. We'd known he was going to Green Team after this deployment, and with his eye, he'd already dealt with so much. I was scared to ask what this injury meant. We just prayed. God knew Adam real well by then. I turned to Romans 8:28, and we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. That became a theme when Adam got hurt. I'd ask, why? And that was my answer. Over the next 4 weeks, Kelly cleaned and debrided Adam's hand. Twice a day, she would unwrap the ointment-saturated surgical gauze from around each finger, pulling away the dead flesh.
There was pus and blood and goo, she says. I was lightheaded the first few times, but I got used to it. His index finger had an exposed nerve, and we'd save that one for last because when I unwrapped it and rewrapped it, it shot a jolt like an electrical shock through him that nearly knocked him down.
The pins and screws were surgically removed the second week in December. Green Team was scheduled to begin in June 2006, less than 6 months away. And
Adam's biggest concern wasn't if he'd ever be able to use his hand for normal things like holding a fork or writing with a pencil, says Kelly. He was thinking pull-ups. Would he be able to hold on to the bar and do 15, the minimum requirement? Would he be able to draw his pistol, pull with his trigger finger, assemble his weapons? He went down the list, everything he knew he'd have to do to qualify, and what he'd have to work on. Because now, both his dominant eye and his dominant hand were a mess.
While Adam's grip gained strength in rehabilitation, his overall dexterity and fine motor skills weren't the same.
A month after the surgery, he began to retrain himself to shoot both pistol and carbine with his left hand. This was far more difficult than what he'd done in sniper school, where single shots were patiently set up, the rifle steadied, if not by its own tripod, then atop a tree stump, log, or whatever was available. And even though he had used both his non-dominant eye and his left hand, pulling the trigger as a sniper was a slow, deliberate move, unlike what he would need to do when faced with split-second decisions in the realistic combat testing of Green Team. Adam's biggest concern was the close-quarters battle, CQB, portion of the course, in which he would have to clear rooms, search houses, react to bad guys. Tough shooting exercises that require both lightning-fast reactions and pinpoint accuracy. "This doesn't even compare to what Adam was up against," says one Green Team cadre instructor. "But let's say you're right-handed and somebody tells you to start writing left-handed. You have to retrain yourself to write fast. You can't drop below the line with your letters. The letters have to be perfect, and you've got to know and write down the answers to do-or-die questions almost simultaneously. And do all this with bad guys shooting at you." Adam had to rewire his brain to react left when his whole life he'd reacted right, in a course where half of the very best guys who have two good eyes and two good hands still fail. By January, Adam was drawing his pistol and making consistently accurate shots. "Almost like he'd been ambidextrous and didn't know it," says Jack Elliott, an armorer who helped maintain weapons for the SEALs. "We teach our guys to shoot with their offhand in case their good one is injured in battle, so I've seen a lot of guys try and shoot non-dominant hand." Adam was smooth. I'd joke with him, "Come on, come clean, you're a Jedi, right?" And he'd say, "No, I just pray a lot." With only a couple of weeks of shooting left-handed under his belt and his fingers barely healed, Adam volunteered for what was presented as an extremely challenging counter-narcotics mission in South America. As the leading petty officer, he headed a 12-man SEAL unit tasked with creating a premier maritime fighting force from the ranks of Colombia's Marines. When he arrived in Colombia and met the 40 Marines who had been chosen for training in a variety of ocean-borne tactics and procedures, Adam found one overwhelming problem. Only about 10 knew how to swim. So, for the first 3 weeks of the tight 2-month schedule, some of the most elite warriors in the world got into a murky swimming pool and, according to one of the SEALs present, coaxed the anxious Colombian Marines into the water. Once they mastered dog paddling, they eventually achieved success at what another SEAL had first considered a hopeless task. Adam's evaluation read, "Selected to head a highly successful counter-narcotics training mission in Colombia. Created and implemented an aggressive training schedule in which 40 Marines and 20 Colombian helicopter pilots were trained in high-risk helicopter, boat, and fast rope insertion methods. He successfully conducted the first-ever helicopter K-Duck boat insertions in Colombia's Special Forces history." Back home in April, Adam was awarded a Gold Star, representing his 4th Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medal for his accomplishments in Colombia. The following month, as he prepared for his transfer to Green Team, the SEALs from Team 2 presented him with a wooden paddle that had a brass plaque on the blade engraved with "The Ballad of Adam Brown." SEAL Team 4 was where you made your debut. Stabbing your face on a dive would be nothing new. At Stennis, you proved insects were a menace. First bees and then ants breached your defenses. Arkansas's finest, PTs never wearied. But who would believe your crazy bubble theory? Standardsville taught you escape and evasion. Save your burning gloves, it was a vacation. A sim fight in Alabama proved you had no fear. But a stray round caused more than a tear. It kept you from combat, this cruel fate, but showed your true character, your lack of hate. Afghanistan should have been your time to shine. I think God was saving you from a landmine. He took a few fingers, but then gave them back. You shrugged it off. It didn't mean jack. So it's off to Green Team, a fate long deserved. A place at the table for you is reserved. Any SEAL will agree when they get in the mix. all would be honored to have you watching their six. Fair Winds and Following Seas, from the Warriors of SEAL Team 2. 2 weeks before his move to Green Team, Adam was clearing out his locker at Team 2 when his chief stopped by to deliver the bad news. Adam had been medically disqualified from the course. His file was reviewed, says another instructor, and even though he'd been cleared and was on the roster, somebody went back in and reconsidered. Figured there is no way he will pass without perfect vision, and because it's a dangerous course, lots of live ammunition, explosives. They did not want that liability. Adam got in his car and drove home.
He was furious and in disbelief, says Kelly. Adam was a man of his word, and he couldn't stand that they were going back and forth. He knew he could do the job and was determined to make it happen.
They explored every angle to appeal the decision, and they prayed.
He said he would leave the Navy and return to school if that was his path, Kelly says. He said he would even shoulder the humility of not succeeding at DevGru, but still be the best SEAL he could be. He'd go to bed disappointed, but he'd wake up fired up, saying, I'm not done.
After a week of hitting brick walls with every appeal, Adam seemed out of options. Then one day, as he drove to work on the base at Little Creek, he noticed the familiar gait of a runner on a trail next to the road. Pulling alongside Captain Van Hooser, his former commander, Adam called out through the window.
Good morning, sir. Can I interrupt your run for a minute?
Despite having commanded thousands of SEALs over the years, Van Hooser knew exactly who Adam was. He remembered the blade incident and how Adam had not interrupted the training dive in spite of his wound. He was impressed by the way Adam had described being shot in the eye as merely a ding, and was aware that he had passed sniper school, just missing being the honor graduate, while shooting left-handed with his non-dominant eye. Adam gave Van Hooser a rundown of his current predicament and said,
Sir, my injuries are no big deal. I can do this. Let me try to qualify. That's all I'm asking. If there is anything you can do to go to bat for me, I won't let you down. I just need the chance.
Van Hooser, a by-the-book Navy man, normally did not interfere with the service's qualification systems. That was my protocol, he says. But like every other SEAL, he'd learned the rules so he would understand if there was ever a time to bend or break them. Let me think about it, he said to Adam. He didn't need to think too long. That same afternoon, he contacted the command at DevGru. A few days after that, he called Adam into his office. They're asking around, Van Hooser told him. It's under review. Dozens of SEALs who had trained or served with Adam from Buds onward received a phone call over the next 2 weeks as Adam's enlisted record and reputation were scrutinized. The response of one SEAL summarized the overwhelming sentiment. It doesn't matter if he's missing an eye or has an injured hand. This is Adam Brown you're talking about. Bring him on. Give him a chance. Days before the Green Team selection process was scheduled to start, Adam was summoned to a meeting with the commanding officer of the training cadre. You're going to be under a microscope, he said. No special considerations. You are up against the same qualifications as everybody else. In fact, you're probably going to be watched more closely than anybody else. But if you pass Green Team, there will never be another question about your eye or your hand. Never. Brad Weston, Adam's buddy from sniper school, along with a few dozen other SEALs from both East Coast and West Coast teams, were sweating. And not just from the humidity. It was the first day of Green Team, and they had gathered at a classified Eastern Seaboard training compound where Brad was amazed to find Adam among those assembled. Because of Adam's eye and severed fingers, I figured his career as a SEAL was finished, Brad says.
Adam? Are you in? Really?
He asked. I'm in, said Adam. They told me I get to stay in the Navy if I can make it through Green Team. Brad slapped him on the back, as did Dave Kane, who had been with Adam in Afghanistan. Only half of the class, which represented the hand-picked best of the best, determined, motivated, and very qualified, would remain by the course's end. And every one of the SEALs had a massive advantage over Adam. They began the course with a PT test that 99% of the world's population would likely fail. First stop, a minimum of 15 dead-hang pull-ups with no time limit. A candidate must come to a complete hang, elbows straight, before executing the next pull-up, in which the chin must come up and over the top of the bar. Adam completed 22. Then, with only a few minutes break, push-ups. All the way down to touch a SEAL's fist under the chest, and all the way up to arms straight, with a 3-minute time limit for a minimum of 80 push-ups. Adam did 120, followed immediately by sit-ups, with a partner holding down feet, 3 minutes to do a minimum of 90. Adam made it through 130. Another short break, then 3 miles of blacktop running in 22 minutes and 30 seconds or less while wearing cami pants and running shoes. Adam's time was 18 minutes and 24 seconds. One last short break before the bay swim, an 880-meter, just over half a mile, side stroke in no more than 13 minutes. Adam finished in 11 minutes, 22 seconds. Adam's scores were average to above average among the students, all of whom passed. After that, the real fun began. 6 months of rigorous training that would take them to specialized schools and facilities across the United States. There they would either exhibit perfection in or fail out of courses in combat, pistol and rifle marksmanship, close quarters battle, military free-fall parachute operations, land warfare, urban warfare, desert warfare, maritime visit, board, search and seizure, VBSS tactics, tactical ground mobility operations, protective security detail training, and various other classified classes. The whole point of Green Team is to create as much stress and pressure on the student as possible and see if they can deal with it, says an instructor who worked with Adam. We don't build them up. We break them down. When something doesn't go as planned or expected, the guys who still perform the task with no mistakes are the guys we're looking for. Says a senior instructor, you either perform under pressure or you fail. And we are not in the business of failing. Although the specific qualifications and training tactics of the CQB phase, the crux of Green Team for most SEALs, are classified, to give you an idea of what Adam had to master, consider where we start them off, says another instructor. CQB begins with two-man teams doing one-room pistol clearance. They're taught to enter the room exactly as we say, clear their lanes as we've instructed, and if there's a target, they engage it, or they handle it if it's a non-combatant. In addition to that, they can only be within 2 feet of where we tell them to be inside the room. In other words, if we tell them to be X number of feet down their lane, if they're under or over that prescribed distance, they under-penetrated or over-penetrated. And that's important, because there are overlapping fields of fire and oversweeps and all kinds of crazy patterns. Sort of like football plays that we have in a playbook that will essentially teach you to storm into any structure and kill bad guys with guns. If you kill a hostage or a civilian, that's a strike against you. Can be grounds for failure. What we're grading on, says a different instructor, is the ability to do what we tell you to do exactly how we tell you to do it. The pressure is piled on. We've got a bunch of cadres hovering over you like vultures while you're doing it, plus you're being filmed. There's one or two guys looking to see if you went down the wall far enough. There's a guy looking at your finger, when it's on the trigger, when it's off. A guy's watching your fields of fire. Someone else is watching your eyes, or in Adam's case, eye, assuring that the scenario is being processed. Another guy's got a stopwatch, and you've got seconds, split seconds, to engage the right targets. You have friendly personnel mixed in with hostiles, and you have people yelling at you. You have to process it all under that pressure and be successful. Most master the one-room scenario, but then the trainees progress to clearing multiple rooms, or they switch to a rifle, or they begin a raid with a rifle, but a situation requires them to draw their pistol. The layout gets harder and harder, with more complicated rooms and multiple levels, and... That's when guys start to fall apart, continues the instructor. And it only gets harder from there, with more variables added into the equation. Complicated entry points, more good guys, more bad guys. The point is, you cannot tough it out. You can't grunt through like buds. These are SEALs. We already know they're tough. Now, we're finding out who's exceptional. We're only interested in the very best. Says a SEAL from Adam's class, they put it to you, physically and mentally, but mostly it's mental. The days start at O-Dark 30 with PT, but they aren't trying to torture you. You aren't deprived of sleep like Hell Week. Some SEALs think Buds is fun, but even those guys think Green Team sucks. If a SEAL makes a mistake in the kill house, the training facility for CQB, for example, a punishment might be extra PT, such as climbing ladders with heavy gear or the tire pull, a tractor tire hooked up to a rope and dragged through a series of wind sprints. That's where Adam ended up, sent by the cadre to the tire pull after he'd swung around in a room and bashed the side of his head into a pole. "Hit your blind spot, huh?" one of his buddies asked, to which Adam replied, "No, man. Don't tell anybody. But that was the side with my good eye." According to an instructor, the Green Team selection process is very specific. Everything is on paper, and you either accomplish what is needed to qualify, or you don't. We were skeptical about Adam because you have to use your peripheral vision a lot. You have to clear corners, be aware of movements to alert you to threats. This meant that while most SEALs glanced left and right, Adam had to swing his entire head around, which ate up fractions of seconds. "We're working against an enemy's reaction time and making sure our guys are faster," says the instructor. So it was amazing. We were all blown away, because he was shooting offhand with a pistol and rifle, and